Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid. I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax and listen to the ghosts of Diffusion past. I'm Ian Wolfe. This week, from the Minidisc Archives, I present to you this Nobel and Ig Nobel Prizes special edition that was first broadcast on the 14th of October 2002, 16 years ago, when the show was called Discovery, and when there were several contributors in the team.
To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour.
Hello and welcome to Discovery, the National Science Radio Show, where the best young scientific minds in Australia come together on a weekly basis to discuss art, science and culture. I'm Adam Mark. On this edition, we'll look at this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry, the pharmacology of absinthe, and a potpourri of scientific tidbits from all over this big blue marble we call Earth. But first up, here's the news with Ian Wolfe.
Do-it-yourself genetic modification is now a reality. Mary Luisa Levitrano's research team in Milan have developed a simple method of washing sperm free of seminal fluid and then simply adding the foreign DNA. The team discovered that interferon in seminal fluid prevents sperm from naturally binding to foreign DNA. Once the sperm is washed free of the interferon in a centrifuge, the sperm will take the new genes inside their cells and add them to parts of its own genome where they will function just by mixing them together. This is a huge improvement over the old technique of injecting DNA into a random place in a newly fertilized egg with a fine needle and microscope, and easy enough for farmers and any first-year biology students to do themselves. You can expect such a simple and precise technique to take off all over the world. A new powder made from potatoes helps blood to clot, and will have uses for minor cuts to surgery and on the battlefield. The potato powder sponges up blood and stops bleeding immediately without any need to apply pressure. Then it triggers a natural clotting mechanism and dissolves itself. It acts so quickly and safely that it may spare the need for blood transfusions, and unlike anything else currently available, it doesn't need any refrigeration or special preparation. It's a purely vegetable product that dissolves within a day, so there's little danger of foreign body reaction or infection. The powder is made of purified potato starch, ground into spherical particles. It's been approved by health authorities around the world and is expected to be on the market next year under the brand name of Bleedex. Gaffer tape, or duct tape as it's known in the US, is so legendary for its many uses that the Annals of Improbable Research staged an opera on the theme, and it's now being used by the US Army to remove warts. Dean Vogt of the Madigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington, discovered that if you tape over a wart with duct tape for a month, it suffocates the wart and it dies. The traditional method of freezing warts with liquid nitrogen is more expensive and is frightening for children. It also isn't guaranteed to produce lasting results, and so it often has to be repeated several times. The idea of using sticky stuff to suffocate warts isn't new, but it rarely works because medical adhesives can't last a whole month. You may recall that we've covered the phenomenon of extremophiles on Discovery in the past. These are bacteria that thrive in extreme conditions of heat and poison and pressure, where you'd normally expect no life at all. An astrobiology team at the University of Texas at El Paso have observed mysterious patches swirling around the sulfuric acid atmosphere of Venus, where the temperature is 450 degrees on the surface and the air pressure is 90 times that of Earth. They reason that at 50 kilometers up in the Venusian atmosphere, water droplets are present, the temperature is only 70 degrees Celsius, and the pressure is normal for Earth's surface, so communities of bacteria could live there. They point to the data from the three Russian and US space probes to Venus that showed hydrogen sulfide and sulfur dioxide, which are normally only found together around life that produces them, and carbonyl sulfide, which is usually seen as a marker for life because it's very hard to produce any other way. Bacteria may be using ultraviolet energy, which would explain why the patches look dark in ultraviolet telescopes. Sulfur-based bacterial colonies are known on Earth to live around volcanic vents around the bottom of the sea and several kilometres deep in the Earth. They also argue that there is chemical evidence that Venus was once cooler and had water oceans, so that perhaps life evolved in the oceans and retreated to niches in the upper atmosphere when things heated up. The European Space Agency plans to launch a Venus mission in 2005 to look at the atmosphere, and the Swedish Space Agency plan to bring back a sample of the atmosphere in 2010. The American researchers expect all US space funding to dry up if they go to war with Iraq.
So you've heard about the newest stars in the Nobel Galaxy, except for chemistry, that is. Chris Stewart plugs that gap with his second Nobel Prize instalment.
A few weeks back, I bemoaned the total lack of excitement in the world of sport, what with the Pakistani cricket team managing to lose the entire series in as much time as it takes to play a one-dayer, and the only unexpected result of the rugby league final being Billy Idol's contractual coup in which he managed to charge the ARL a truckload of money not to sing. Fortunately, around about the same time at the start of October, the non-boofhead world rejoiced in the announcement of the winners of the intellectual equivalent of the Festival of the Boot, namely the Nobel Prizes in Sweden. Back then, I reported on the prize winners in physics and medicine, so this time I'll turn to the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, which, like the other scientific prizes this year, was shared three ways. Half of the roughly 10 million kroner, which is about 2 million Aussie bucks, was split between John Fenn from the USA and Koichi Tanaka from Japan. The other half of the dosh went to Swiss chemist Kurt Wuthrich. The common theme for the award was the development of methods for identification and structure analyses of biological macromolecules. And what, pray tell, is that? What's a biological macromolecule? Well, you know what a molecule is, yeah? A bunch of atoms that are bound together. Well, oxygen, O2, is a simple two-atom molecule. Water, H2O, is a three-atom molecule. Biological macromolecules are, as the name suggests, biological in origin, and the macro bit means that they're just really, really big. The molecule that makes up our genetic code is a prime example. Deoxyribonucleic acid, I always trip over that one, or DNA to its friends. It's a molecule comprised of many, many hundreds of atoms joined together in a complex double helix structure. The information stored in our DNA is made physical in the creation of the many different proteins our body uses to do all of those things we associate with being alive. Proteins are also biological macromolecules, and they are also very complex. Long chains of atoms that get wound and folded and tied up in knots, but not randomly. The shape of a protein is as integral to the purpose of that molecule as the sequence of atoms itself. So, in the game of understanding the many intricate processes going on within living organisms, you can appreciate that these macromolecules need to be pretty well studied. You need to understand the mechanism through which DNA is read, how proteins are formed, and how they interact and function, before you can really do any work at all on important problems like genetic diseases or mad cow disease or Alzheimer's. Which raises the excellent question, just how do you study an incredibly complex molecule when it's very, very small? I mean, you can't simply whack one under the microscope and have a look. This year's Nobel winners in chemistry all found ways to contribute to the understanding of macromolecular structure. Fenn and Tanaka developed methods for applying the important chemist's tool of mass spectroscopy to macromolecules. Mass spectroscopy means the sorting out of different molecules in a solution according to their mass, hence the name. It's an old technique. It's been used for years with small or medium-sized molecules. And areas of chemistry such as drug testing and environmental analysis will be lost without it. You can do a kind of mass spectroscopy with a box of muesli, believe it or not. You can sort the heavy bits from the light bits just by shaking the box. The light bits rise to the top and the heavy bits sink to the bottom, through the mixing effect of shaking and the influence of gravity. With molecules, one way to sort out the heavy from the light is to get them all into gaseous form, give them all a bit of a kick of energy and measure how long it takes them to cover a certain distance. The lighter ones will move faster than the heavier ones in a very predictable way. The trick, however, is that if you give macromolecules a big enough kick, they tend to fall apart a bit. They lose their characteristic structure, and the whole point of the exercise is pretty much lost. However, these days, chemists have two ways of performing mass spectroscopy on macromolecules. One, called electrospray ionization, is due to John Fenn. That's why he got his award. He realized that the molecules would keep their structure if he got them into a gaseous state using strong electromagnetic forces. They would become ionized, which wouldn't affect their mass terribly much, but would keep them curled up really nice and tight. The second method, due to Koichi Tanaka, uses pulses of laser light to gently but firmly blast a sample into its constituent molecules, which are then generally ionized and happily float away as a gas. But that's just half of this year's chemistry prize. The other half went to Kurt Wuthrich for his application of nuclear magnetic resonance, or NMR, to the problem of understanding macromolecular structure. NMR is a technique that allows chemists to go beyond the question of what is the molecule and how big is it, to the more difficult question of what does it look like? The technique rests on the discovery that certain wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation, of light, are absorbed by atoms due to the magnetic properties of their nuclei. In a complex molecule, where the chain of atoms are all wound around and folded up, the atomic nuclei are arranged in a pattern specific to that particular molecule. Now, when two atoms are close together, their nuclear magnets react to each other's presence. This means that different frequencies of radiation are absorbed depending on the position and orientation of the atoms in the molecule. By shining electromagnetic radiation of many frequencies on a complex molecule, an intricate map of the different absorbed frequencies can be found. From this, the relative positions of the atoms can be worked out. It's a bit like knowing where all the intersections are on a street map. You can pretty quickly fill in the gaps to show where most of the streets must have been. With NMR, chemists had a tool that could find the locations in a complex molecule where atoms are in close proximity. But with hundreds or thousands of atoms, where do you begin to start deciphering this very difficult join-the-dots puzzle? Well, Wuthrich found the solution. He discovered a method of systematically assigning the absorbed frequencies from the NMR to the hydrogen atoms in the molecule, and there are always hydrogen atoms in biological macromolecules, bunches of them. This method, called sequential assignment, led to a way to find the distances between many different pairs of hydrogen atoms in the molecule, get enough of those distances, and you can begin to put together a 3D picture of the molecule. So that's it for the Science Nobel Prizes for this year. Check out www.nobel.se for all the goss on the physicists, the medical practitioners and the chemistry winners for 2002. Or take a peek at the prizes for literature, economics and world peace. Or, if you must, dig out the baggy green cap and the off-whites and settle into the armchair to psych yourself for the inevitable when Warney, McGrath and co. take on the big pointy stick at the Poms in the upcoming Ashes series.
Well, that's all for the Nobels for 2002. Just think, it's only 12 months away until the next big announcements from Sweden.
Hi, I'm Gates McFadden, and I played Dr. Beverly Crusher on Star Trek The Next Generation. And I know Dr. Crusher very well, and I am sure that when she's off duty, she would urge you to listen to Discovery, the national science program on 2SER-FM. Make it so.
In 1999, my cousin took me on a big night out in Soho, London. As a naive little boy from the central coast of New South Wales, I wasn't really wise in the ways of the world. When she offered me a drink called absinthe, which would make me hallucinate and was very popular in the gay community, I didn't know quite what I was going to do. So, like any person overseas on tour, I had a drink. And unfortunately, it didn't make me hallucinate. But recent reports in the Sydney Morning Herald has found that, long since banned in Australia, absinthe is now available. Actually, it's only available in certain hotels who need pretty much a license to be able to serve it because of its potential toxic properties. What is absinthe, I hear you ask? Well, funny you should mention that, because I'm going to tell you right here tonight. Absinthe is a bright green liquor flavoured using a herbal extract. The drink was popular in the 19th century, especially in France, with the bohemian crowd. The drink is green in colour due to the chlorophyll present. Due to the drink's very potent nature, it was traditionally diluted with cold water. The water was added through a perforated spoon containing sugar, and sometimes you can actually light it due to its high alcohol content with a bit of a flame, quite spectacular. When the water was added to the drink, it goes from the emerald green colour to a cloudy white colour. This occurs because the water causes the essential oils from the herbal extract to precipitate out of the alcohol and form a colloidal suspension. Chronic uses of absinthe led to absinthinism. The symptoms for this addiction included epileptic attacks, delirium, and hallucinations. Due to this and other social considerations, absinthe was banned in many countries during the early part of the 20th century. A typical recipe for the herbal flavouring extract attributed to Henri Louis Pernod, who was famous for his other drink, called Pernod, funny should I say that, calls for a ground-up mixture of aniseed, fennel, hyssop, lemon balm, angelica, star anise, dittany, juniper, nutmeg, veronica, and wormwood. A steam distillation of this mixture is then done. More wormwood is added to the distillate and then diluted with ethanol to 75% alcohol by volume, a very potent mix. The drink, which is supposed to be green in colour, due to the chlorophyll as I mentioned in the past, was often made more green artificially by the addition of copper sulfate, cupric acetate, turmeric and anil green. Antimony trichloride was also added to aid in the colour change when water was added. These additives increase the toxicity of the drink, but the more important problem is the extract of the wormwood, also known as Artemisia absinthium. Wormwood contains the product or the compound absinthin, which is responsible for the bitter flavour of the liquor. But the main toxicant is the essential oil, thujon. It is known to be psychoactive and is the main ingredient in absinthe other than alcohol. Thujon belongs to the family of monoterpene ketones. There are two basic forms of this found in wormwood, the alpha and the beta. They make up 90% of the wormwood oil's weight. But alpha thujon has a much higher toxicity than the beta, and the ratio in nature of alpha to beta thujon is 1 to 2. Thujon is a colourless liquid with a menthol-like smell. It is insoluble in water, but soluble in ethanol or alcohol. Thujon is found in other plants including cedar leaf, sage, tansy, thyme, rosemary and thuja, its namesake. Trace amounts can be found as a flavouring agent in alcoholic beverages such as vermouth, wormwood is actually German for wormwood, chartreuse and benedictine. Traces can also be found in Vicks VapoRub, perfumes, and in pest repellents for rodents and mites. The pharmacology of thujin has been used in, the pharmacology behind this is that it's been used in herbal medicine and is said to cure digestive problems, worms, menstrual problems, corns, warts, acne, fever, cough, rheumatism, scurvy, and dropsy. It is reported to have antinocitive or pain-relieving effects. It's also been used as an anti-insecticide and anti-thelmetic activity, whatever that is. Rice and Wilson found that alpha-thujin had comparative antinocitive effects, pain-relieving effects, compared to codeine when injected subcutaneously in rats. When you actually torture them using hot plates, they actually go off a little quicker. Other cultures have discovered thujin's intoxicating effects. In West Bengal, Artemisia nilgirica is a thujin-containing plant, is smoked for its psychoactive effects, and the Zuni smoke Artemisia caruli as an analgesic. For a while, it was hypothesized that thujin and tetrahydrocannabinol, the good stuff in cannabis or marijuana, has the same side of action. This was believed to be true because of the similarities in their structures and effects. But in 1997, it was shown that neither thujin nor wormwood binds to the actual cannabinoid receptor. Until recently, it wasn't known what the mode of action for alpha-thujin was, but a recent study by Hold and colleagues at Berkeley University have found the toxin's mode of actions. The researchers found that alpha-thujin is rapidly metabolized in the liver and breakdowns into two specific metabolites. The alpha-thujin is found to be 56 times more potent in rats than in houseflies, actually. But enough of the science. Let's look at the real things about absinthe. While the use of wormwood can be dated back as far as the 1550 BC, it became the rage in France starting back about 1850. Its use took hold in the intellectual and aristocratic communities, and many famous people, Hemingway, Picasso, Degas, Van Gogh, drank absinthe. It was thought that it stimulated creativity and acted as an aphrodisiac. Perhaps the most famous drinker, as I mentioned, was Vincent van Gogh, for it appears that his depression, psychotic behaviour and suicide were related to his chronic use of the drink. Van Gogh suffered from this acute intermittent porphyria, which is a problem with the liver. The symptoms of this genetic disorder included attacks of abdominal pain, anxiety, hysteria, delirium, phobias, psychosis, organic disorders, agitation, depression and altered state of consciousness from tiredness to coma. It has been theorized that the drinking of absinthe may have triggered these attacks for poor Vincent and actually also be linked to the cutting of his ear. So, the next time someone offers you a drink of absinthe in the bar, why not throw caution to the wind and have a taste of the green fairy? And finally, here's Chris Stewart with some late news.
Yes, well, it wouldn't be complete to report on the Nobel Prizes without mentioning their ugly younger sibling, the Ig Nobel Prizes. I mean, if you're going to celebrate all that's great in human endeavour in a given year, you may as well just go the whole hog and say, let's also celebrate, as the Ig Nobel Prize Committee states, the research that perhaps shouldn't have been done, or even more perhaps couldn't be repeated. So, with that in mind, this year's 2002 Ig Nobel Prize winners. Now, the Ig Nobel Prizes are given out at Stanford University, and they're given in all of the fields for the Nobel Prizes, as well as some extras. So this year's Ig Nobel Prize for Medicine was given to Chris McManus of the University College of London for his report on the scrotal asymmetry in man and ancient sculpture. Very important. What we have to remember is that this is real. This is all real research that was published in Nature. Physics, Arndt Leek of the University of Munich for demonstrating that beer froth obeys the mathematical law of exponential decay. I'm sure they spent many hours in the lab doing that one. That was published in the European Journal of Physics. Chemistry, Theodore Gray of Wolfram Research in Champaign, Illinois, for gathering many elements of the periodic table and assembling them into the form of a four-legged periodic table. Thanks, guys. Yes, the Ig Nobel Prize for Literature was given to Vicky L. Silvers of the University of Nevada, Reno, and David S. Kreiner of Central Missouri State University for their report on the effects of pre-existing inappropriate highlighting on reading comprehension, i.e. when you get the book out from the library and some idiot's gone through it with a yellow highlighter. That was in Reading Research and Instruction. The Peace Ig Nobel Prize goes to Kita Sato, president of Takara Company, Dr. Masumi Suzuki, president of Japan Acoustic Lab, and Dr. Norio Koguri, executive director of Koguri Veterinary Hospital, for promoting peace and harmony between the species by inventing Bowlingual, a computer-based automatic dog-to-human language translation device. But there were a bunch of others as well. There was the Ig Nobel Prize for Hygiene, which was given to Eduardo Segura from Spain for inventing a washing machine for cats and dogs. There was the one that you've probably heard about, which was the Ig Nobel in Interdisciplinary Research, Dr. Carl Krasilnicki from the University of Sydney for performing a comprehensive survey of human belly button lint, and the one that I like the most, the Ig Nobel Prize for Mathematics, went to K.P. Srikumar and the late G. Nirmalan of the Kerala Agricultural University in India for the analytical report, which was published in Veterinary Research Communications, Estimation of the Total Surface Area in Indian Elephants. The name of the paper, Estimation of the Total Surface Area in Indian Elephants. That's the Ig Nobels for 2002.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Discovery. If you'd like to contact us, you can reach us via email at
science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com.
Contributing to the program were Ian Wolfe, Chris Stewart, and me, Adam Mark. Discovery has been produced by Chris Stewart, with technical assistance by Gina Sartori in the studios of 2SER Sydney. Discovery is broadcast nationally via ComradeSat by the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. I'm Adam Mark. Join us for more science-encrusted chatter next week on Discovery.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.